She kept it away from the press, and she didn't tell any of the victims that they were possibly part of something much larger. As far as the public was concerned, there was no serial rapist terrorizing the Shenandoah Valley. Amy hated the thought that, because of this, there were doors being left unlocked, or women leaving themselves unwittingly vulnerable to attack, or evidence going uncollected because she couldn't appeal to citizenry for help. All because of Aaron Dansby's political ambitions. It was the sort of thing that could make even the most hardened addict forget about Dancing with the Stars. Chapter 5. As I sat on the ground outside Shenandoah Valley Social Services, my mind was a forest thicket of thoughts, all of them from my tangled past. My first contact with the system came when I was 2 years old. My father, in one of his drunken rages, had grabbed me by the arm and thrown me across the room, giving me a green stick fracture. I don't actually remember it. A caseworker told me about it, years later. It helped me understand why my arm sometimes hurt when it rained. My mother once told me my father wasn't always a violent man, that being a father had brought it out of him. They had met in the Navy when they were both stationed in Norfolk. She described her first interactions with Chief Warrant Officer William Theodore Curran, Billy to his friends, in fairy-tale-like terms. They were Billy and Betsy. They both came from small towns in Pennsylvania. He was tall and broad-shouldered, romantic and charming, and so on. That seems to be at least somewhat at odds with his dishonorable discharge from the Navy, which he earned via a series of infractions committed while drunk or hungover. My mother was already struggling to balance working for the Navy with raising my half-sister, Charlotte, who came from a brief and failed marriage to another seaman. When her enlistment was up, Dad packaged her departure from the Navy with a marriage proposal. She eagerly said yes. The new Mr. and Mrs. Curran moved to Northumberland County, which was tucked away in a rural part of Virginia known as Northern Neck. They liked having a small house in the middle of the woods, without any neighbors nearby. Maybe Dad liked that part more than Mom. Dad became a commercial fisherman, and the pattern of their life was pretty simple. My father would go out on long trips at sea, sometimes for weeks at a time, then return to her, happy and flush with cash. Life would be good for a little while, until he started drinking. Then, inevitably, he'd get pissed off about something, or nothing, and beat the hell out of her. One time, I recall, he went berserk on her because there were some ants crawling in the garbage, the result of her slack housekeeping, he claimed, and that she had allowed creeper vines to climb up the house while he was gone. Other times it was money, or because he imagined she had flirted with some guy, or because of some transgression only he understood. The next morning, he'd apologize, swearing to God he was never going to do it again. Then he'd go back out to sea. When he returned, the cycle would repeat itself, like some kind of brutal tide. Why my mother, who had once been smart and pretty and surely had better options, stayed with a man like that is testimony to how abuse can alter a person's psyche. She not only stayed, she doubled down on the relationship, giving birth to me. By then, I think Mom already knew what she was in for. My middle name was supposed to be Hope, after Dad's grandmother. But when the hospital asked her what to put on the birth certificate, Mom changed it to Anne without telling him. 9 years after me, there was the surprise, accident, miracle that was my brother, Teddy. I don't know why my mother thought having more children would change my father or tame him. It surely didn't. Some of my earliest memories are of an assortment of caseworkers, their brows creased with concern as they tried to pull details out of me about the latest episode. My childhood became a revolving door of living situations. I never fully understood the logic of the caseworkers, why some of my father's tirades resulted in removal from the home, while others, which had seemed to me much worse, did not. I came to fear the group homes, which could be savage tests of survival between hardened foster kids who had learned to battle for whatever meager scraps of love, food, or adult attention that might be available. The foster placements were more hit or miss. Some were nice enough that I cried when I was ripped away from them to be sent back to my parents. Others were rougher, particularly the ones that were so obviously only in it for the paycheck. The state chipped in about $500 a month for my housing, feeding, and clothing, and it was amazing how little of that some of them could spend on me. One of my foster mothers had a biological kid, a girl, to go along with three foster kids, two boys and me. The girl had her own room. I shared a room with the two boys. When we weren't in school, the three foster kids were booted out every day and told we couldn't return to the house until dinner. We were given a small bagged lunch, which I usually finished by about 10:30 in the morning. I have these memories of long afternoons in the backyard, peering jealously through the windows at my foster sister as she ate snacks in front of the television. At another home, I was one of eight foster kids crammed into two bedrooms. The foster mother enjoyed pitting us against one another, encouraging us to report minor transgressions, and then devising punishments for whoever had committed them. One time, after one of my compatriots turned me in for having hoarded a small stash of food in the closet, she cut off my hair in uneven chunks. Then she marched me into the boys' bedroom in my underwear and forced me to tell them I was a sneak and a liar. These placements were followed by returns home for stints that could last anywhere from a few months to a year or so, depending on how artful my father was at hiding the results of his angry hands and how much he could cow my mother into silence. My mother loved me in her own fashion. She called me Pumpkin, a name that still makes my skin crawl a little, and brushed my long hair much more tenderly than any foster mother did. She always made sure I had access to books and let me read as much as I wanted, allowing me to disappear into imagined worlds that were so much less chaotic than my own. But she didn't do the one thing she really ought to have done to protect me, which was leave Billy Curran for good. The pattern, home, then foster care, then home, continued until I was 9. By that point, my mother was fully addicted to the pain pills that were prescribed to her every time my father gave her a fresh round of bruises. Eventually, she started having sex with a doctor in exchange for a steady supply of Vicodin, Percocet, or whatever he could get his hands on. She was in a stupor one day when Teddy was found crawling out near Route 360, the major thoroughfare in Northumberland County, wearing nothing but a dirty diaper. Social services swooped in again, like usual. But that time, my half-sister, Charlotte, dropped the bomb that my father had been sexually abusing her, pretty much from the moment she developed hips. A caseworker delivered my drug-muddled mother an ultimatum: get sober and leave her husband, or lose her children for good. She chose him over us, voluntarily signing over her parental rights. Only people who work with the chronically abused and chemically dependent could recognize her logic. That was 22 years ago. I haven't had contact with either of my parents since. Once I became a full-time ward of the state, my life only became more unanchored. I understood there was no going home anymore, because I didn't have one. But I could never anticipate when the next move was coming, Nor was anyone especially concerned with explaining to me why it was happening. Had I done something bad? Were my straight A's not good enough? If I were a better kid, would they have sent me to a nicer place? Who, exactly, should I be most angry with? My latest foster parent? My latest caseworker? Myself? Then, sometime in college, I decided I was through with the overanalyzing, the recriminations, the attempts at truth and reconciliation. Being a foster kid had defined my childhood, yes. But it was only going to define me as an adult if I let it. I had survived. That's what mattered. And I never had to go back. So to now have Alex coming into contact with that world was a vicious kind of cruelty, like an aftershock from an earthquake that should have been too far gone to still move the ground. Yet there I was, sitting outside social services, shaking and cowering from this fresh trembler. Eventually, I picked myself off the ground and wobbled to my car. Ben would be home soon. I wanted to be there when he arrived. Our house is a tidy, three-bedroom post-war ranch. It sits alongside the eerily monikered Desper Hollow Road, named decades ago after the Desper family, a few of whom still live there. It is just outside the Stanton city limits, in what is quite literally the other side of the tracks. As soon as you turn off Route 250, you cross under a railroad trestle. We bought our place when we first learned I was pregnant. I told Ben I couldn't bring the baby home to the ground floor apartment where I had been living. Not after what had happened there. I wanted a proper house, one with four walls and a white picket fence and cheerful little flower boxes hung under the windows out front. It must have been the pregnancy hormones, filling me with the urge to feather a nest. Ben, who was in the final throes of earning a PhD in history, made a few noises about the enormity of his student loan debts, which would begin crushing us not long after he finished his program. He also pointed out we had no idea where he would end up getting a job. There had been hints he could maybe, possibly, hook on at James Madison, where it was looking like there might be a retirement in the history department around the time he defended his dissertation. But there were certainly no guarantees. We had to be ready to move anywhere. Ultimately, though, he gave in. We took our entire rainy day fund and sunk it into the down payment, then started hoping like hell it never rained. We closed on it last October, when I was about 7 months pregnant, then spent the next 2 months fixing it up as much as we could before Alex made his big arrival. We borrowed a power washer to clean the grunge off the exterior. My friend Marcus came over with hedge trimmers and hacked back the overgrown bushes, allowing light to pour through the windows. His wife, Kelly, helped us paint. Then there was Ben's surprise housewarming present to me. A beautiful, brand-new white picket fence. He was coy about how he had come up with the money for it. He joked he had sold a kidney. We also hung some flower boxes under the windows. It was too late to really put anything in them, but Ben found tulip bulbs on end-of-season clearance, and, together, we stuck them in the dirt. For someone with my peripatetic past, there was a wonderful optimism about being able to plant something that wouldn't show itself for many months. This was the first place I could ever really think of as permanent, after 31 years of near-constant itinerancy. And it was both dizzying and dazzling to think that by the time those flowers blossomed, we'd have a baby. The green shoots had started to come up not long ago. Being that we were deep in the grind of new parenthood, the sleepless nights, the early mornings, the tyranny of an infant's demands, it was a nice reminder of the excitement we once had. I tried to reassure myself as I made the turn onto Desper Hollow Road and crossed under the tracks, that Nothing had really changed. I was still going to gape at those flowers with Alex, watching one tiny miracle discover another. This was going to end up okay. Then I reached the mailbox at the end of our driveway and made the turn up toward our house. That's when I realized there was police tape stretched across our front door. Chapter 6. Once I was out of my car, I saw the yellow tape wasn't the only way in which the peace and tranquility of our home had been disturbed. The flower boxes had been removed and emptied. The dirt was piled on the ground next to them. The bulbs were lying on their side, scattered haphazardly about. Some of the stalks had been bent or broken by the rough treatment. My hand flew to my mouth. I felt my throat constricting again. Had the police done this? They must have. But why? And did this have something to do with Alex? They told me all about you. I hope they get that baby as far away from you as possible. After a few halting steps, I stopped, almost afraid to enter my house. If this is what they had done to the flower boxes, what would the inside look like? I stood there, paralyzed by uncertainty and dread. Soon my attention was diverted by a flashlight beam, bobbing my way from down the hill. I felt myself stiffen. For a lot of reasons, I'm uneasy about being approached by strangers in the dark. Or any other time, for that matter. I relaxed, a little, when I heard a familiar voice say,
"Hey, saw you driving up."
It was my neighbor, Bobby Ray Walters, a large slab of a man whose ample body fat had curiously solid properties. Bobby Ray was one of the last remaining Desper descendants. He saw nothing wrong with flying the Confederate flag outside his trailer, eagerly seized on every conspiracy theory that floated across the internet, and lived in this fantastical alternate reality where the government was coming to strip him of his guns any moment. He often referred to his large stockpile of munitions in casual conversation, and, in case anyone missed the hint, there was a hand-painted sign that read, "Warning, Second Amendment Enthusiast," prominently displayed outside his trailer. He also protected his property with a series of cameras, which he advertised with another hand-painted, if grammatically impaired, sign that read, "Smile, you're on camera." Our differing attitudes about politics aside, he was the kind of guy who never met a stranger. If he was sitting in one of the beat-up couches he used for outdoor furniture when I drove by, he waved, usually with his non-Budweiser-holding hand. He even cut our grass for us after we moved in when he realized we didn't yet own a lawnmower. Once or twice, he said things that made me think he had spent time in prison. I didn't pry into the details. And now I found myself backing up a step or two as he crowded my personal space.
"Sheriff was here,"
he volunteered, in case I hadn't figured it out.
"I saw him rolling up about 3 o'clock. There were like 5 or 6 of them. They walked right into the place like they owned it. Didn't knock or nothing. Two of them started digging up your flowers like they were looking for something in there. They were just throwing dirt everywhere. So I came over and said, 'Hey, you don't need to go doing that.' They told me to mind my own business and just kept doing it, the some bitches."
He spoke with a kind of clannish affection for me that I hadn't heard before. I could guess why. To people who have no idea how I grew up, I come off as having an air of privilege. They heard my Yankee accent, the words I used or the ideas I expressed, all of which came from books I got out of the library, for free, and assumed it was the result of having parents who lavished money on private schools or sent me to Europe for the summer. They didn't look carefully enough at my teeth to see that I never had braces. They definitely didn't see me after I graduated college, unemployed, but without parents to move back in with, like most of my classmates. I was 3 months behind on my rent when my landlord told me he was kicking me out unless I gave him a blowjob. He further suggested he could pimp me out, and that I might have a nice income waiting for me if I would dye my dark hair blonde and surgically enhance my B cups into D's. That was how I ended up living in my car. When I finally landed that job at Starbucks, I was just grateful they didn't notice I was sneaking food off customers' trays until my first paycheck came in. Now that I was back on my feet, I'd like to think I hid those scars well. So, to Bobby Ray, this was my rite of passage, having the sheriff's office run roughshod over my stuff, just like all the other poor white trash.
"They came over when they were done, and I told them to get the hell off my property," he continued. "I guess they wanted to know if I'd seen a lot of people coming and going from your place. Like, you know, was you selling drugs and stuff?"
"Drugs?" I blurted.
"Well, that's what I said," Bobby Ray insisted. "I told him, no, no, you got it all wrong. It ain't like that. Her husband, he's a professor or something up at the university. They high class. But they just looked at me like maybe I was hiding something, like I must have been in on it or whatever. You know how they look at you, like they already made up their minds you're a piece of crap."
He took in a sharp breath, then held it, stifling the hiccup that was trying to escape. "Yeah, I know," I said. He looked at me with renewed sympathy.
"Don't go getting your panties in a twist. Sheriff's gonna do what the sheriff's gonna do. Long as they didn't find nothing, you got nothing to worry about."
Then he bobbed his head toward the bulbs.
"Except maybe getting yourself some new flowers."
"Uh-huh," I said, bringing my hand to my mouth again. Bobby Ray stuffed his hands in his pockets and shivered a little.
"All right. If you need something, just give a holler," he said.
"Thanks, Bobby Ray." And then he was off, his flashlight beam pointing back down the hill toward his trailer. I turned to face my house. Long as they didn't find nothing, you got nothing to worry about. I took a deep breath. There were no drugs in my house that I knew of. I would never bring something like that near Alex. I'm not sure I could say the same about his Uncle Teddy. The boy who was born William Theodore Curran Jr. got his name from my father. I can only assume his taste for medication came from my mother. He was just a baby when we were taken from our parents' home for the final time. Our caseworker was an astute woman who understood that I had basically assumed the role of Teddy's mother, changing his diapers, feeding him, bathing him. If we remained together, I'd keep right on doing it, depriving me of a childhood and Teddy of a more suitable mother. So she split us up. She literally had to pry him from my arms. She promised he would stay close by and that I could visit him whenever I wanted. But that was a lie. While I languished in foster care, Teddy was quickly adopted by a local couple. Then his new parents moved to Stanton. For me, losing Teddy was far more devastating than having my parents terminate their rights. Charlotte had already vanished by that point, having fled from a group home. Teddy was my entire family. I conned his new address out of my caseworker, saying I wanted to write him a letter. Then I ran away from my foster home, taking a bus to Stanton. After the third time I did this, my caseworker offered a deal. If she found a placement for me in Stanton, I'd behave. That's how I ended up in the Shenandoah Valley. To me, Teddy was a beam of pure sunshine, a creative, energetic little boy. To everyone else, his adopted mother included, he was a problem child, obviously dyslexic, though his mother resisted having him tested. Acting out in school from a young age, a troublemaker. Before long, vandalism begat cigarettes, which begat marijuana, which begat harder drugs, and the petty thefts required to support his burgeoning habit. I kept up a relationship with him the whole time, but I couldn't stay on him the way I needed to. Being penniless and near starvation doesn't leave you with a lot of wherewithal to help others. He started running around with a girl named Wendy Matea, who was as beautiful as she was dangerous. They made quite a pair. Teddy was broad-shouldered and handsome, like my father, and they spent their high school years scoring drugs, partying, and racking up juvenile records. When Teddy turned 18, I sat him down and staged my version of an intervention, convincing him that the consequences of stealing and dealing were about to become a lot more severe. I then convinced his parents, who were just about through with him by that point, to fund his tuition at a local vocational school, where he learned HVAC repair. To his credit, Teddy buckled down and earned his certificate. He then found a job and moved into a large house he shared with three other guys, one of whom was a young sheriff's deputy, none of whom he knew from his drug days. I was thrilled. Once Alex was born, Teddy made noises about how he planned to be a devoted uncle. But after a spate of visits early on, I hadn't seen him as much recently. My friend Marcus had shown more interest in Alex than Teddy had. I thought maybe Teddy was just busy. Now, as I cleared away the police tape, I wondered what he had really been up to. Teddy had a key to my house. Knowing he couldn't risk bringing drugs into his apartment, not with a sheriff's deputy for a roommate, had he stashed them at my place? I entered through the front door into the scene of a catastrophe. My once tidy home had been ransacked. In the living room, all the furniture had either been knocked over or shoved out of place. Picture frames had been removed from the walls. The television was lying face down. Ben's jazz records, a collection of hidden gems he had found at yard sales or used shops for 50 cents or a dollar, even though many of them were worth far more, had been toppled from their place of honor on the shelf in the entertainment center and left in loose piles. Books, my beloved books, had been pulled from the shelves and stacked haphazardly. In the kitchen, all the drawers had been yanked out of the counter and emptied, their contents strewn about. Plates, bowls, and glassware had been removed from the cabinets and dumped on the kitchen table. Pots and pans littered the floor. In our bedroom, the mattress and box spring were leaning against the wall. My dresser drawers had been pulled out and left wherever it was they landed. Most of our clothes were tossed in a heap in the corner, except for my bras and underwear, which were in the middle of the room. Someone wanted me to know they had received particular attention. The loving sanctuary we had worked so hard to make for ourselves had been defiled. Along with it came the destruction of the myths I had built for myself. That I was somehow safe here. That this place was different. That bad things couldn't reach me as long as I was inside these four walls. Nothing was broken, at least not that I saw. But they had gone out of their way to make our home as much of a shambles as possible. Anything that didn't have an implicit value had been tossed about or trampled. "We can do this to you," they seemed to be saying, "and there's nothing you can do back." I ended my tour in the nursery, which hadn't been spared the authorities' fury. Alex's crib was lying on its side. The contents of his changing table were everywhere. His little onesies had been unfolded and flung into a mound along with loose diapers, tubes of A&D ointment, packages of wipes, and all the other bits of babydom that had once been organized so perfectly. Up in the ceiling, There was a gaping hole where the air conditioning exchange cover should have been. It had been removed and placed over near the closet, leaving the vent wide open. In the corner, I spied the plush bear Marcus and Kelly had given Alex, a little guy named Mr. Snuggs, according to his tag. Poor Mr. Snuggs had been knocked off the shelf where he lived. I picked him up and put him on the changing table. It was impossible, in all the destruction, to tell if they had discovered any drugs or where they had found them. But they must have gotten something. That's why Alex was now with Social Services. I slumped into the rocker glider where I often nursed Alex. Like some Pavlovian reaction, my nipples sprung leaks. Ordinarily, I would have fed Alex hours ago. My breasts were now rock hard, so swollen they felt like they were going to rupture. I needed to do something to relieve the pressure. My electric breast pump, the one provided to me by my fabulous insurance plan, was stored at work. So was the hand pump I used as a backup. I didn't need those things here. I had Alex. There was no choice. I staggered into the bathroom and unbuttoned my blouse. I lowered the now sodden flap on my nursing bra. Then, trying not to see myself in the mirror, because I didn't even want to know what I looked like at a moment like this, I lowered my breast toward the sink and began massaging around the nipple. The milk came instantly, thick at first, then thinner once I got it going. All the while, I watched as the precious fluid that should have been nourishing my baby disappeared down the drain. Chapter 7. After coffee, after a shower, after an omelet, and after a quick perusal of the Washington Post on her iPad, Amy Kay figured she had dawdled enough. Her bravado with Aaron Dansby aside, she actually did need to familiarize herself with the Coke Mom case if she was going to write up a bill of indictment for the grand jury. Her interview with Daphne Hasper wasn't until 10 a.m., still 2 hours away. Amy thought she might as well get her call to Sheriff Jason Powers over with. Powers was a tobacco-dipping, Reba McEntire-loving, huntin', fishin' country boy through and through. In defiance of stereotypes, he never seemed to have a problem with Amy being a northerner or a woman. Amy had always found him both easy to work with and competent. Now well entrenched in the job, Sheriff Powers did not keep a predictable schedule. He might be in the office, or he might be patrolling the fairways at a local golf course. He was a notorious night owl and seemed to enjoy roaming around the county during the small hours. Patrol officers knew not to spend too much time hanging out at Sheets, because it was entirely possible the boss would show up unannounced, driving his personal vehicle, and catch them loafing. Amy sometimes got emails from Powers at 5 in the morning, and sometimes 10 at night. She wasn't sure when he actually slept. She simply called him when she needed him, knowing she would either get him or not. This was one of the times she got him. "Hello," he said. "Hey, Jason, it's Amy Kay." "What's going on?" he said in typically easygoing fashion. Unlike Dansby, who was constantly paranoid about re-election, Powers had faced the voters twice now, and his father 6 times before that. They had never lost. "I wanted to check in with you about this bust on Desper Hollow Road."
"Oh, so now that Dapper Dansby is done with the cameras, the real work can begin?"
"Something like that."
"What do you need to know?"
Powers asked.
"How'd you get probable cause?"
"CI?"
A confidential informant. The standard-issue infantry rifle in the war on drugs.
"He'd do a buy for you?"
"Yep."
You pay him?
Yep. $100.
Not that it mattered, but it had to be disclosed. The defense usually tried to make an issue out of it, painting it as the prosecution buying its information. The argument typically didn't get much traction. Juries didn't care.
Have you used him before?
Yeah, a couple of times.
That was good. The law made a distinction between confidential informants who had previously provided information and new ones. Veteran CIs were deemed reliable and didn't have to be named in a search warrant. It was one less avenue of attack for defense attorneys whose first and best play in cases like this was to attack the validity of the warrant.
Who executed the warrant?
Amy asked.
Camp.
Another good break. Lieutenant Peter Skip Kemp was as solid a detective as could be found at the Augusta County Sheriff's Office. He was authoritative, but not overbearing about it. He presented information in a straightforward fashion that came off as incontrovertible fact. Amy had put him on the stand during the Mookie Myers case, and was pretty sure at least four of the jurors wanted to invite him over for dinner when he was done.
He do it clean?
Yeah, as far as I know, no troubles.
Aaron told me they got half a kilo of coke. Is that
Dapper Dansby stretching the truth?
Powers said, laughing.
No, he got it just about right. 487 grams. Almost as much as Mookie Myers. Same brand as Myers, too.
In a sign that drug dealers were every bit as cognizant of the importance of product differentiation as Madison Avenue advertising executives, illicit drugs in modern America often came with brand stamps. The idea was that certain brands were better quality, something that mattered to a discerning junkie.
Dragon King, right?
Yep.
So, what, you think this lady took over Myers's operation?
Looks that way. We found scales and baggies and all that, but we also found a list of customer names and numbers. It's a lot of the same folks who bought from Mookie. Some of our favorite people.
But how does a white woman with a kid end up having any connection to someone like Mookie Myers?
Don't know. Maybe she was a customer? Doesn't really matter, does it?
Virginia's statute regarding possession with intent to distribute was written in a way that meant the Commonwealth didn't actually have to prove a dealer had made a sale. The law presumed that a person who possessed enough product was planning to sell it.
No, I guess not, Amy said. Where did you find it, anyway?
Taped inside the air conditioning duct in the nursery.
The nursery?
Yeah, I guess this lady figured that'd be the last place we'd look. The supplies were in a closet. Oh, and you're gonna love this. In the same box where she kept the supplies, we also got her cell phone. Had pictures of her and her kid on it and everything.
Oh, perfect, Amy said. Merely finding drugs in a defendant's home might not be enough to establish possession. You had to prove the person knew the drugs were there and had what the law called dominion and control over the materials. Pairing drug paraphernalia with the defendant's cell phone, and not just some anonymous burner, accomplished that quite nicely. In the modern world, few things were more personal than someone's mobile phone.
All right, Amy said. Anything else I need to know?
Nothing that comes to mind. This should be pretty open and shut. You want me to have Skip call you?
Yeah. I've got a meeting shortly, but sometime this afternoon would be great. Will he be available for a grand jury on Friday?
Dansby wants to direct indict.
I'll make him available.
Thanks, Amy said. By the way, what's the defendant's name?
Melanie Barrick.
Amy nearly dropped her phone.
What?
She said sharply.
Melanie, common spelling. Barrick. B-A-R-R-I-C-K.
Amy couldn't talk. And from the other side of the phone, Powers had no way of knowing just how dumbstruck she was.
You got anything else?
He asked.
I'm about to tee off here.
No, I'm good, she squeezed out.
Okay, see ya.
Amy put down her phone, then spent a minute staring at her kitchen table. She didn't know Melanie Barrick personally, but she did professionally. Melanie Barrick was one of the Whispering Rapist's most recent victims. Chapter 8. Call it a flashback, or some kind of post-traumatic stress reaction. There was just something about spending the evening in my ruined home, steeping in that feeling of violation, that took me back to where I had been almost exactly a year before, to a day, a place, and an episode that was suddenly revisiting itself on me, even though I certainly hadn't invited it. The day was March 8th. The place was that awful ground floor apartment. The episode began when I felt a gloved hand clamp over my mouth, jolting me out of a sound sleep.
"Please don't scream,"
a man said in a whisper that was, all at once, both ethereal and terrifying.
"I don't want to have to hurt you."
In the scant glow of a nearby streetlight that snuck around my blinds, I could see a man in a ski mask hovering over me. The hint of skin that showed around the eye holes told me he was white. The rest of him, arms, hands, legs, neck, was covered. My first thought was that I should bite his hand, even if it would just give me a mouthful of glove. Then I would kick him, then claw his eyeballs, then, with his other hand, he brought a machete up to my face. It was a thick, heavy chunk of metal at least 18 inches long. Its steel had turned dark, basically black. Only its sharp, cruel edge remained silver, and it glinted at me.
"I'll only use this if I have to," he whispered. "Do you understand?"
I nodded.
"Am I going to have to hurt you?"
I shook my head.
"I'm going to take my hand off your mouth now. Can you please stay quiet?"
He removed his hand.
"Are you going to be good? You can answer."
"Yes," I said meekly.
"Thank you. Now could you please remove your top?"
I complied, resorting to a survival technique I had learned in childhood. I pretended that I could take a piece of myself, the most important part, and lock it in my heart, where it would be safe from the rest of the world. It was a trick I sometimes told my fellow foster kids about, and it helped me again with that loathsome whispering man. For as much as I wondered later about what would have happened if I resisted, should I have tried to fight him off? Should I have screamed and hoped it scared him away? Should I have peed on him or found some other way to gross him out? Should I have run? The mere fact that I was around to have those thoughts eventually made me decide I had done the right thing. He took my bed sheets and the clothes I had been wearing when he was done, then disappeared out the same window he had jimmied open to let himself in. When I was sure he was gone, I put on a sweatshirt and jeans, then called Ben and asked him if he would come over. He was just my boyfriend then, though we had been dating exclusively for some time. The irony was that he had kept trying to convince me to move in with him, but I didn't want to give up my independence. He held me through the night, crying with me the whole time, reminding me he loved me, saying it wasn't my fault, telling me there was nothing I could or should have done differently. In the morning, he convinced me I had to call the police. The professor in him cited all the statistics about the underreporting of rape, saying the crime was never going to get the attention it deserved until its true prevalence was better understood. The boyfriend in him was just angry. He wanted to nail the bastard who had done this to me. That led to a long day of reliving the attack, first with the sheriff's office, then with the prosecutor, a woman who asked a lot of detailed questions. At one point during our interview, she made a reference to the rapist's black machete being held in my face. "I didn't say anything to you about the machete being black," I said. "How did you know that?"
"Oh, I thought you said it was black," she said.
But she was a terrible liar. "I'm not the only one, am I?" I asked. She didn't reply to that. She didn't need to. I already knew, from the way he acted with me, that he had done it before. The sheriff's office got my attacker's DNA off the rape kit, though naturally it wasn't a match for anyone in the system. Between that and my totally worthless description, the authorities got very quiet, and the case went unsolved, just as I somehow suspected it would. And then? Well, then nothing. I went on with my life. I don't want to make it sound like I just shrugged the thing off. Far from it. I couldn't get that awful whisper to leave my mind. It was in there all the time. All day and, worse, all night. It made me feel like my assailant was forever around the corner, waiting to pounce. Logically, I knew I was just imagining it. But don't underestimate the power of human imagination. It's given us everything from world-changing religions to the atomic bomb. It's more than capable of keeping a 120-pound girl chained to her mental demons. For weeks, I was afraid to stay in my apartment, but I was also terrified to leave. I felt exposed and vulnerable wherever I went. Even worse than hearing the echoes of that whisper was the feeling when I saw a man whose proportions resembled my attacker, which was a lot of them, given how average the guy was. It made me wonder, is that the guy? Is he right now envisioning me naked, scared, totally in his control? And then it was like being right back in my bedroom, tasting that glove. Even friends could trigger the reaction. The first time I saw Marcus, who had never been anything but chivalrous in all the years we had known each other, I freaked out and had a full-blown panic attack. Ben suggested therapy, but I knew it wouldn't help. I had done therapy before, as a kid. I didn't need to talk the thing into submission. Within a lifetime of crappy things that had happened to me, this was just one more crappy thing. Or at least it was, until I learned I was pregnant. That was an extra kick in the uterus I really wasn't ready for. In a life where there had already been so many things outside of my control, I couldn't even decide when I got to reproduce. I seriously considered an abortion, if only because there was no chance, and I mean no chance at all, I was going to consider adoption. Not after my own experience in the system, to say nothing of Teddy's. A few things stopped me from ending the pregnancy. One, I wasn't actually sure whose child it was. Ben and I had a condom break a few days before the rape. There was always the spermicide to act as backup, but we couldn't be sure. Two, and this was probably the larger factor, I felt this overwhelming love for the thing growing inside me. I was 7 or 8 weeks along by the time I went to the OBGYN. She did an ultrasound and then asked me if I wanted to hear the baby's heart. The question caught me by surprise. I'm not sure I had even considered that it had a heartbeat yet. I nodded, and the OBGYN reached for a knob on her machine and turned up the volume. At that moment, any ambivalence I had about the pregnancy disappeared. That miraculous sound. Ka-chunk, 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 doing a vigorous double time, filled the examining room. I can honestly say I had never heard anything so remarkable, so beautiful. It already didn't matter whether the pregnancy started with an act of love or an act of violence. That baby was mine, not my rapist's. Just because he owned the episode didn't mean he got to own the result. Ben asked me to marry him not long after. We still didn't know who the father was. He said he loved me and the baby so much already, it didn't really matter. When the baby came out, blonde and pale and quite apparently not his, Ben never acted like anything but an excited new father. That was just Ben, steady, reliable, ready to roll with whatever happened. Ben had begun wooing me while I worked at Starbucks, not long after I had finally scraped up enough money to move out of my car. He was a good-looking guy, a little younger than me, with flawless dark skin and a wiry body that tapered to a V at the waist. Every time he came into the shop, he found a way to make me laugh, whether it was with a sly, offhand observation about how a customer had acted, or a self-deprecating joke. He was obviously very bright. But it was his empathy that most attracted me to him. In each comment he made, I could tell how good he was at seeing the world from other people's perspectives. It was a rare trait in a guy. In anyone. He later admitted he frequently drove by Starbucks, but only came into the store when he saw my car. It took him 3 months to gin up the courage to ask me out on a date. By then, it felt easy to say yes. Marcus, who had watched this slow courtship up close, gently asked me if I knew what I was getting myself into, dating a black guy. It wasn't because he had any personal objection to it. He just understood that while Stanton was a progressive town, it was still in the South, located roughly in the middle of a state that only surrendered its anti-miscegenation laws in 1967, and only after the U.S. Supreme Court ordered it. In truth, Ben got more resistance from his side than I got from mine. His friends back home teased him about how he was just another black guy who wanted to get with a white woman. Some of his older family members asked why he couldn't just stick with his own kind. But really, it was pretty much a non-issue. I got used to the occasional stares, mostly from old white people, when we got close to each other on dates. I met his parents, who were lovely from the start and didn't seem to have any concern about the color of my skin. We certainly didn't have to worry about introducing him to my family. As things progressed, Ben's devotion to me only got more flattering, something I wasn't sure I was even worthy of after so many years of having my self-esteem battered. I had stopped thinking of myself as intelligent. I mean, how smart could I be? I worked at Starbucks, right? Until Ben came along and reminded me of it. Because, make no mistake, he was brilliant. Enough to overcome the not inconsiderable obstacles of race, poverty, and growing up in a family where no one had gone to college. He had earned a full academic scholarship at Middlebury College, then graduated Phi Beta Kappa. If someone that smart loved me, it must have meant I wasn't as dumb as I thought, right? Ben's thesis advisor at James Madison, Richard Kramer, was one of the nation's foremost scholars in post-Reconstruction-era U.S. history. Ben was his star student. With Kramer's guidance, Benjamin J. Barrick had already published a few journal articles. Kramer even thought Ben might be able to get his dissertation published as a book, which would really put him in the stratosphere of young historians. Every now and then, we'd permit ourselves to daydream about when he completed his Ph.D., and slid into the job that would, we hoped, open up at JMU at just the right time. It was tenure track, and Kramer had said he would throw around his weight for Ben to get it.
We'd never have to worry about money again.
Beyond that, Ben was just exceptionally well-grounded. He didn't have a lot growing up either. His parents worked jobs that paid low hourly wages, and every generation before that picked cotton. But his family was super solid, church-going, pillar of the community types. Our dynamic, which somehow established itself pretty quickly, was that I had a troubled present and a screwed-up past. He didn't. So he helped me overcome mine. The downside to this arrangement was that he wasn't always the best communicator when it came to his own issues. If anything, the bigger they were, the less likely he was to say anything at all. But we were on familiar turf here. This was another time when my troubles became his troubles. After Ben got home, we spent the night talking things through. He concurred with me that whatever the sheriff's office found in our house must have belonged to my brother. I had called and texted Teddy but got no response. Ben went over to his place, but his roommates said they hadn't seen him. Long term, we had to get Teddy to admit the drugs were his. If that meant he got in trouble with the law, so be it. There was exactly one thing I wouldn't sacrifice to save Teddy, and that was Alex. More immediately, we had to plead our case to social services, trying to make them realize we weren't drug addicts or child abusers. Ben went online to figure out how we might do that. He soon found a handbook for parents in child dependency cases, which we began poring over. Within 24 hours of taking a child, social services had to file a petition with the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court for an emergency removal order. As far as I could tell, there wasn't a thing we could do to fight an emergency removal order in court. It was just an attorney for social services telling a judge what horrible parents we were. If the judge agreed, we would have an attorney appointed to us. Within 5 business days, there would be a preliminary removal hearing, where the judge would make an initial finding of abuse and neglect. 30 days later, there would be an adjudicatory hearing, where that initial finding would be confirmed. Then there would be a dispositional hearing, where the judge would approve social services' foster care plan. And on and on. The document finished with an admonishment in bold type, framed in its own box. Unless you do what the court requires, you could lose custody of your child forever, it read. Start working now on the things you need to do. I knew we had to stop the system from latching its teeth into us in the first place, and the only way to do that was to convince social services not to file that emergency removal order. That was what had inspired us to spend 3 hours that morning feverishly putting the house together, shoving things back into place without bothering to organize them, just in case someone wanted to do a home visit. All the while, I could practically hear the system's drum beats. A tribe of cannibals was massing. And it was hungry. Chapter 9. We arrived at Shenandoah Valley Social Services a few minutes before its scheduled 8:30 a.m. opening time. It wasn't much more inviting in daytime than it had been the night before. Though exhausted, we had made a game attempt to clean ourselves up. I had put on a dress with cap sleeves and a prim neckline. There wasn't much I could do with my hair because I didn't have time for a shower, so I pulled it back and anchored it with a barrette. I only hoped a fresh dusting of makeup stopped me from looking like a total zombie. Ben nailed the part of a young academic. He wore slacks and a blazer that was 2 elbow patches away from being promoted to full professor. His thick-framed glasses, he jokingly called them his Malcolm X glasses, gave him an even more studious air. His shirt was well-ironed and neatly tucked. He once explained his fastidiousness came from not wanting to give the white world an excuse to tag him with any of the labels it liked to pin to young African-American men. Taken in sum, I thought we looked like responsible parents.